Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. In today's episode, we're going to be talking about digestive health, more specifically small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, often referred to as SIBO or SIBO, some people pronounce it as. But before I go into digestive health today, I thought I would just tell you about my morning so far, which has been very stressful. I've recently started selling some old clothes, mostly activewear, on Vinted. And I don't know if it was something about being in South Africa and living out of a suitcase for 3 weeks where you only have a very small wardrobe to work from, and then coming home and just feeling like perhaps even from the change in my nervous system that I experienced on holiday, just feeling like there was like too much clutter and too much stuff. So I've really been feeling like since I got back from South Africa in December, just need to kind of unburden myself. I think of a lot of the things that I've been holding on to. And if you want to get like really philosophical about it, you could also think that through this whole healing journey, I've changed as a person in so many different ways. And some of those old things and old belongings, the belongings more so of the old self versus the new self. So I really wanted to kind of like lighten the load, so to speak, and feel a little bit lighter moving forward. And then I ended up taking a whole bunch of stuff to the charity shop, which was great. And then when we had a little cold spell recently, I realized I needed a new winter jacket. And I never used Vinted before, so I bought myself just a secondhand jacket on Vinted. It was really great. It was really great value. And then I just decided, oh, maybe I should just sell some of these other things that I want to clear out from my home that are still in condition, good condition on Vinted. So basically spent the whole weekend like photographing things, uploading things, made quite a few sales, which was great, and then ran off to the post office first thing Monday morning to get everything all sent. And then realized I pressed the wrong button on one of the labels I needed to generate, where I was supposed to generate a QR code to print the label in store. I generated a label that needed printing, and my printer is currently out of ink, and it was too early in the morning to go to a print shop to get it printed. So I spent about an hour just standing outside Tesco trying to like work out if there were any ways around getting this label, but they were not. So eventually I decided to come home with a very activated nervous system, and I worked out I can go get some printing done, hopefully at the local library, which I'll maybe try and do after this episode. But that is just really a very pointless anecdote, a little bit of an insight into my life on a Monday morning before I record this podcast. And yeah, I'm feeling a little bit wired. Hopefully it won't come across too much as we talk about digestive health today, but I thought I would just share that with you. So, boring story over. Let's go into the podcast details for today. And we're talking about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and how it factors into chronic fatigue. I myself experienced small intestinal bacterial overgrowth as part of my chronic fatigue journey, and I would say also independent of my chronic fatigue journey. And I'll speak more about that in a moment. Although I never did any formal testing for it, I'm pretty sure it was something that I was experiencing. And I work with clients who have done SIBO testing and some clients who haven't done SIBO testing, but we suspect that that's what's going on. So we see this a lot in our practice, myself and Francesca, and I also see a lot of relapsing SIBO as part of this picture of chronic fatigue. And I'll talk a little bit about that and why people are more susceptible to relapse in these chronic complex conditions. So today we're just going to talk a little bit about what it is. I'll talk a little bit about the idea of working north to south when we work through or when we work on digestive issues and why that's important. We'll talk about how it impacts chronic fatigue syndrome and the different mechanisms by which it impacts our energy, how you know if you've got it, what are the symptoms, and then, well, most importantly, talk about, you know, how do you know if it's a problem for you and what do you do if you suspect it is a problem, because that's what everybody wants to know is, like, what can I do about this? How can I improve my energy? So that's what you can expect from listening to this episode today. So let's first of all start with the basics, and maybe even going to a very, very surface level and just talk about the gut as a whole. So the gut is basically just one big long tube which runs from your mouth to your anus. And when we're thinking about digestive processes are also starting in the brain and in the nervous system because we have this brain-gut connection. So if we're working through the digestive system from the top down or north to south, we're thinking about the health of the brain, the health of the nervous system. We're thinking about the mouth, the health of the mouth, chewing, the ability to produce saliva, stomach acid, what's happening in the stomach. Then we go from the stomach to the small intestine, which is what the focus of today is going to be. And then from the small intestine, food moves into the colon. And then from the colon, we eliminate food through the anus. And in between all of that, we've also got the gallbladder, which is making bile. We've got the pancreas, which is making pancreatic enzymes. And they're involved in the digestive processes as well. So when we're referring to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, the small intestine is the portion of the intestine which is between the stomach and is between the colon, which is the large intestine. And as the name suggests, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth is a condition which is characterized by an abnormal increase in the number and or type of bacteria in the small intestine. So there's a lot of popularity these days. If you're in this kind of like wellness space, you probably have heard already about the microbiome. When you're hearing about the microbiome or the microbiota, or people are talking about bacteria, what they're often referring to is the types and the number and the species of bacteria that live in the colon, because it's in the colon that we have large amounts of bacteria. But relatively speaking, we have less bacteria in the small intestine. And so small intestinal bacterial overgrowth can be due to a migration of excessive amounts of bacteria up into the small intestine, or it can be just an overgrowth of the bacteria that are in the small intestine. And this can lead to specific intestinal symptoms, so symptoms in the small intestine or in the digestive tract itself, or it can also lead to extra intestinal symptoms, symptoms outside of the intestine. So sometimes people think that they have no digestive symptoms, but they do have a lot of systemic symptoms like brain fog, like joint ache, like hormonal imbalances, like nutrient deficiencies, which are originating from the gut, maybe the small intestine. So SIBO can include a range of symptoms, including things like bloating and abdominal pain, diarrhea, constipation, alternating between diarrhea and constipation, gas or smelly flatulence, and malabsorption of nutrients. But the symptoms can vary from person to person. And as I've said already, is that some of these symptoms can be extra intestinal. They can manifest as fatigue, brain fog, some of the other symptoms that may go hand in hand with chronic fatigue, chronic illness, and other syndromes. So the association between small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and chronic fatigue is an ongoing area of research. There's, you know, it's really kind of hard to do systemic research because, especially from a functional medicine perspective, we're looking at the human body as a series of interlinking systems. And it's really difficult to study one system in isolation because it's being influenced by so many other systems. It's the difference between a reductionist model of healthcare versus more of like a systemic model of healthcare or functional model of healthcare. And so it is really difficult to draw like strong correlations like X equals Y. But there are connections that can be helpful to understand when we think about the link between digestive health and our energy levels and chronic illness in general. So one of the first kind of mechanisms to consider would be just immune system activation, so activating the immune system. SIBO can trigger the immune system response as the body reacts to this overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine. you could kind of think of it like a low-level infection, which is, you know, getting the immune system a little bit grumbly. And this immune system activation can lead to system-wide inflammation. And that's where the symptoms of SIBO can become systemic, not just gastrointestinal. And that can be one of the reasons why we experience fatigue or why we experience brain fog, especially if you're noticing, if you're eating certain foods and there's not a blood sugar issue, but you experience more fatigue and brain fog after eating, that could be because there are some food reactions happening. It also could be due to the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Another potential mechanism is impaired gut barrier function. So SIBO can compromise the integrity of the intestinal layer of the small intestine, and that can allow bacteria and their waste products to enter into the bloodstream. Many people may be familiar with the terminology leaky gut, or we often use the term intestinal permeability, which is a little bit more professional, shall we say. And if we've got intestinal permeability and there's bacteria growing in the small intestine, they're producing waste products, just like we as humans and animals and, you know, plants even produce their own waste. That waste needs to go somewhere. It either needs to be detoxified through the gut or it can go into the bloodstream. And once in the bloodstream, sometimes these substances can trigger an immune response, and that can potentially increase systemic inflammation. It can also heighten neuroinflammation. And again, we can get those symptoms of fatigue, brain fog, can also impact mood. So there are multiple different mechanisms by which we can experience the symptoms of these bacterial waste products entering into the bloodstream. So neuroinflammation is something that I've spoken about several times now on the podcast. I've got a few specific episodes on neuroinflammation and glial cell priming and brain injury. So those sort of terms resonate with you, or you know it's something on your radar that you're already dealing with, you can listen to those. But activation of the immune system in the gut will send signals to the immune system in the brain. And if you've got a primed immune system in the brain, which we would refer to as glial cell priming, then that can, any kind of inflammation that's happening in the body can increase the inflammation in the brain. And that can be experienced as cognitive symptoms, low mood, fatigue, needing to sleep a lot, feeling very activated. There's multiple different experiences of that. Another very important consideration is malabsorption. So we actively absorb nutrients through the small intestine. And if the integrity of the small intestine is compromised, that can compromise the absorption of nutrients. And that can lead to deficiencies of vitamins and minerals. And that in turn can contribute to fatigue. The most common, or the ones that people are most aware of, are things like vitamin B12 deficiency, folate deficiency, iron deficiency, which would then impact the red blood cell size and quality and number, and that could lead to conditions like anemia when we're not oxygenating the body properly and we need that oxygen to make energy. But other nutrient deficiencies can impact the immune system, can impact our muscle mass, can impact the energy cycles of the body. So there's thousands of biochemical reactions happening every single day that are important to our health and well-being. And if we don't have the nutritional cofactors to support healthy biochemical function, that can manifest in disease generally and fatigue more specifically. And then the final thing, which I actually have already touched on, is just the concept of increased toxin production, because all organisms produce their own toxic waste. And if there is an overgrowth of bacteria and these bacteria are producing harmful substances, then those harmful substances can enter into the bloodstream, overload the body. And then if you've already got mold or something that you're dealing with in the liver is already working a little bit more sluggishly, it's just another load which is filling up the bucket and overwhelming the body as a whole. And then the topic that everybody really loves to talk about, which is the dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. SIBO can influence the autonomic nervous system, which controls our involuntary bodily functions. And dysregulation of the system has been observed in people with SIBO and chronic fatigue. And there is obviously a link between the two. So it's important to note that while all of these mechanisms are proposed, the relationship between SIBO and chronic fatigue is complex and it varies among individuals. And this is actually just me rehashing a conversation I had with a client recently, is there are people who have SIBO and don't have chronic fatigue. There are people who have chronic fatigue and don't have SIBO. So it's not necessarily X equals Y. Sometimes people are like, if I can only just like master my SIBO, then I'll have all the energy in the world. Yet those people, when their digestion does stabilize, they don't necessarily always feel as good as what they had hoped. So I think it's always important just to understand that chronic illness is complex and nuanced, and everybody experiences it differently. And yes, if there is suspected SIBO and I'm working with someone with a chronic fatigue or a chronic illness, we definitely want to address that, but we want to address it in the context of everything that's going on with that person. And I'll just do a little spoiler here, is that very often when I see people who are constantly relapsing with their digestive health, it's often because there's a missing piece of the puzzle. And that missing piece of the puzzle can be, but is not always, because they haven't done enough nervous system work yet to allow the stability they've achieved in their digestion to sustain itself. So sometimes people push forward with the physical pieces, but they're not supporting alongside that with the nervous system pieces, however that looks for you. And therefore, that can often be the like two steps forward, two steps back dynamic, because the physical body is healing faster than the mental and emotional body, for want of a better way of putting it. So that is something to be aware of. So now that you understand a little bit about how these digestive imbalances can link with energy and fatigue, maybe it would be helpful to know what the symptoms are. And I've alluded already to the gastrointestinal symptoms. And generally speaking, these could look like bloating, so feeling of fullness and distension in the belly after eating, abdominal pain or discomfort, cramping or just generalized discomfort in the abdominal area, diarrhea, so just unexplained bouts of diarrhea, constipation, whether that's chronic constipation or just a little bit of sluggish bowels or alternating between diarrhea and constipation. Then we also have nutritional symptoms and malabsorption symptoms, so losing weight, unintentional weight loss, difficulty to maintain weight or put on weight, and nutritional deficiencies, so anemia that you can just never get on top of, or other types of deficiencies that are showing up perhaps in testing. And then we can have more systemic or generalized symptoms, so fatigue, obviously, feeling tired, lacking in energy, and that could be due to the various mechanisms that we've already discussed, or joint pain, brain fog. Sometimes SIBO can also be associated with gastroesophageal reflux disease, often referred to as GERD. So noticing that you're getting heartburn around meals can be a sign of SIBO. So perhaps you resonate with a lot of these symptoms and you want to know, but is this really a problem for me? Is that diarrhea that I'm experiencing SIBO, is it something else? And so it's important to understand that SIBO is typically diagnosed through specialized testing, the most common of which being the SIBO breath test. And this is typically not a test that your regular NHS GP is going to say, let's do a SIBO breath test. Might be something that you have to do privately. And, you know, many people are diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome because they have constipation, diarrhea, tummy pain, but they've never even done a SIBO breath test. So my suspicions are that many people who have been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, not necessarily all, could potentially just have SIBO, that nobody's ever explained to them what it is and how it impacts the body. So I digress. But the breath test measures gases produced by bacteria in the small intestine after the consumption of a liquid carbohydrate. So basically, you drink this liquid solution, you capture your breath, and then they are able to measure the levels of specific gases in your breath to confirm, yes, you have SIBO, no, you don't. However, testing can produce false positive and false negative results. So it's not always 100%. no testing is 100%, but especially with these breath tests, they can have a little bit of a higher margin of error. So therefore, we always want to consider the other pillars of functional medicine, which is taking a thorough health history, looking at the symptoms, looking at testing, if it's been done, if it's needed, and also how does someone respond? Because if we give someone support for SIBO and they get better, then we know that, okay, that was probably what it was. We don't necessarily always need to have a positive test result. And so the other thing to also think about is, does someone have signs of malabsorption? And, you know, have they got celiac disease? Do they need to be referred for an endoscopy? You know, have we ruled out other things like intestinal autoimmunity? Are there gut-brain axis problems? Are there issues with stomach acid? Are there any parasite infections? Is there any sort of gut degeneration? So generation of the neuroplexus of the gut. So we kind of want to consider all of these things as well. In my practice, I never recommend SIBO testing. It's a personal choice. If I have clients who want to do it, I'm like, sure, you can do it. But I don't feel that it's, you know, people are usually on a budget. I do have a few clients who aren't. But a majority of my clients, it's a big investment for them to be doing this work with me and paying for the fees and the supplements and the testing. And therefore, we want to just prioritize where and how they're spending their money as much as possible. So I would rather assume that there is SIBO and support it than being running multiple tests all the time, which have a degree of inaccuracy. So that's just a personal way that I like to practice, but other practitioners are different. So then what do you do if you suspect that you have SIBO? Maybe you've done a test, it has come positive. Maybe you really resonate with the symptoms and you suspect that it's probably an issue for you. So it usually, as with most of these things, involves a comprehensive approach that can include a combination of medical treatment. So your doctor, if they're supportive of that this is something that is affecting you, they may give you an antibiotic. But we can also use antimicrobial herbs. So that's what I would do in my practice because I can't prescribe antibiotics. We want to use dietary change, and we also need to manage the underlying factors that may have contributed to the bacterial overgrowth in the first place. And so here, and this is where it might be worth me just taking a little bit of a pause and circling back to this idea of the gut being how we support the gut is from north to south. And I explained in the beginning of the episode how we've got the brain, then we've got the mouth and we need to chew, then we've got the stomach where we need to have adequate stomach acid, and then we've got the pancreas, which produces pancreatic enzymes, and we've got the gallbladder, which needs to contract and release bile. So when we're working north to south, if someone has SIBO, before we just go in and give a whole bunch of antibiotics, or before we go in and just give a whole bunch of antimicrobial herbs, we need to systemically go through how is this person's brain and nervous system? Has there been a brain injury? Are there any signs of neurodegeneration? Or is this person just really, really stressed and like their autonomic nervous system is dysregulated and they're in fight or flight and freeze all the time? So that's one, that's the North Star. Then we come down to two, which is like what's happening in the mouth. Are they chewing properly? Because if we don't chew properly, then we have poorly chewed food going into the gut. And that's like a party for bacteria that are overgrowing in the small intestine. Now, are we producing enough stomach acid? Has this person had a history of H. pylori? Do they have stomach acid issues? Because the acidity of the stomach is going to impact the pH further down the gut. And if we have a higher pH in the stomach because stomach acid production is poor, then we have an opportunity for the bacteria in the small intestine to thrive because the acidity of the stomach is kind of not keeping their home environment in check, so to speak. So when there's lower levels of acidity, there's more potential for bacterial overgrowth. And then finally, you know, how is this person's pancreatic enzyme production? Because the acid and the enzymes are also breaking down and digesting food. And that poorly digested food, if those functions aren't working well, is again creating more fodder for these bacteria to feed off and produce their waste products and overgrow. And then the gallbladder. The gallbladder, I'm actually going to record a podcast in a few weeks on the gallbladder, so you can listen to that when it comes out for more information. But we also know that the bile, which is released by the gallbladder, has a significant impact on the balance of bacteria in the gut. If you've got gallbladder dysfunction, if the gallbladder isn't contracting, if the bile flow isn't good, if there's gallstones, if there's any issues there with the gallbladder, that's something that's also potentially going to be impacting this bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. So at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned how I work with clients who have this relapsing SIBO that comes and they get rid of it. They take antimicrobials, they do bits and bobs, and then it comes back, and then they get rid of it, and then it comes back. It's very often because those more northerly steps have not been attended to. The brain health and the nervous system health hasn't been appropriately addressed. There's maybe poor chewing, maybe poor saliva production. There may be problems with stomach acidity. There may be problems with pancreatic enzyme production. And there may be problems with the gallbladder. And if they've just jumped to taking an antibiotic to deal with the SIBO, but they've not attended to all those things that come first, then it just means, yes, the antibiotics wipe out the excess bacteria, but the environment is still there once those antibiotics are gone so that the bacteria can regrow and then the symptoms come back. So yes, we can use antibiotic treatment for SIBO. Yes, we can use antimicrobial treatment for SIBO. And my preference is usually to use herbs like oregano or berberine or garlic. There's a variety of different types of herbs we can use, but we must do all the steps. We must work north to south when we're supporting digestive health. Dietary change is also going to be really important. Specifically, the most research is behind a low FODMAP diet, where FODMAP stands for fructose, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So these are types of carbohydrates that are found in our healthy foods like fruit and veg, and they're more susceptible to fermentation by bacteria in the small intestine. And it's when we eat these foods and we have the bacterial overgrowth, they produce gas through that fermentation process. And that's the gas you may measure in a breath test, but that gas is also a cause for slowing down gut motility, causing constipation, or increasing gut motility, causing diarrhea, or alternating between constipation and diarrhea. It will also cause bloating, distension. It can be associated with pain. So it's this gas production which is driving a lot of the symptoms. And so following a low FODMAP diet under the guidance of your healthcare practitioner is a very often necessary step. I usually recommend my clients check out the Monash University app. They are the university that's done the most research into the low FODMAP diet, and they've got a really nice app which will tell you like which foods are moderate, low, and high in FODMAPs. And there are also various resources on my website as well of my own experience following a low FODMAP diet, but I highly recommend the app. If we're using probiotics and antibiotics, we want to probably be giving the body, if we're using antibiotics and antimicrobial herbs, we probably want to give the body some probiotic support. Taking probiotics when you have SIBO has been a little bit controversial in some cases. Some people say taking probiotics with SIBO can make you worse. I don't think that is always the case. I don't think it's true for everyone. Some may be really well tolerated, but you can always play around with different strains. For example, soil-based organisms, Saccharomyces boulardii, could also be really, really helpful. The kind of catch-22 when it comes to SIBO is that SIBO can cause poor gut motility. But then once we have poor gut motility, then we've got food and bacteria stagnating in the gut, which is increasing that gas production. So we want to make sure that bowel movements are regular. And sometimes bowel movements are regulated through addressing the SIBO. But things we want to think about is following a low FODMAP diet, but still eating enough fiber that we can bulk out the stools without aggravating SIBO. And I think everybody's gut is different, but there can be this misconception that you need to eat like a lot of fiber to not be constipated. And really, I think it's about eating the optimal amount of fiber for you and addressing the bacterial imbalances and the nervous system so that you cannot be constipated. Because for the most part, I follow a ketogenic diet, which is low in FODMAPs. and I'm not constipated. And that really is the amount of vegetables I eat is like one like large salad a day. So I make a large salad in the morning with my breakfast, massive salad bowl, and then that I eat across two meals. So I have half of the salad at breakfast and then half of the salad with my lunch. And then I'll either have another salad for dinner or I'll have some vegetables for dinner, like some courgette or, you know, some lower FODMAP vegetables. So this actually not like, it is probably a lot of veg. Most people aren't eating salad for breakfast, but I don't eat any grains. I'm not eating any fruits. I'm just eating one massive salad and a couple of vegetables each day. And that is enough to keep me regular because it suits my body. So I think there can be a lot of misconceptions that like more is better and you need a lot of grains or you need a lot of bulk or you're not going to get enough fiber on a low FODMAP diet or you're not going to get enough fiber on a ketogenic diet. And I don't think that's true. I think that sometimes it's just the anxious part of people that are worrying about everything instead of just moving forward with their health. So talking more about regularity, we also want to make sure that we're properly hydrated. That's something that I do. I do drink a lot of water. We're managing stress, we're moving a lot. So I do a lot of walking in addition to the other exercise that I do, which I think is helpful. We need to address additional infections. So sometimes there can be parasites or yeast and mold, which are also part of the picture and impacting the gut motility. And we need to rule out things like, is there a thyroid disorder? Is there a thyroid problem that's causing the constipation? Is there a brain injury? Is there some early neurodegeneration? Is there Parkinson's disease, which is also slowing down the gut motility? And then finally, probiotics and also just ruling out any medications that have a negative impact on the gut motility. If you really struggle with gut motility, a lot of my clients with SIBO do. We can use supplements in the short term that can support the gut motility, but the long-term goal is to not to need them. There are natural agents that can help as well, like ginger, peppermint, chamomile, fennel, lemon balm, aloe vera, artichoke, prune juice, although careful of the sugar. Turmeric. So those are all kind of things that you can consider. And I've kind of mentioned this already, but it's also important if this is a ongoing thing, if you keep on relapsing, we need to rule out any underlying conditions such as abnormalities that are affecting the motility of the gut. So autoimmune dysmotility, a brain injury, neurodegeneration, gastroparesis, post-viral esophageal dysmotility. And, you know, these conditions are when you really want to be working with a practitioner, somebody who knows what they're doing so that you really can be supported and experience the best quality of life longer term. And then finally, we also want to be thinking about nutritional support. So if there are nutrient deficiencies, how do we identify those? And then what do we do to support the body with better digestion absorption of these nutrients? In some cases, it may actually be that we need to use a lot of supplements to make sure that the body needs. Some of my clients get iron infusions. Some of them get B12 injections. So there's lots of different ways the body perhaps does need to be supported. In my own journey, I did the Nutrival test, which is a blood test by Genova Diagnostic. And mine was horrendous. I always say mine was the worst test results I've seen. All my clients' test results have been better than mine, because I had so much malabsorption from having chronic diarrhea for such a long time. So you know, there's obviously simple tests you can do with your GP. There are more advanced tests you can do. But as part of the overall picture of your health, it's important that these nutrients are repleted. And then we should probably talk a little bit about lifestyle modification. I've discussed already the importance of working from north to south, and the brain and the nervous system are the North Star. So managing stress and adopting a healthy lifestyle is going to have a big impact on overall digestive health. And we all need, whether you're sick or not, we all need stress management techniques because life is stressful. We need regular exercise within capacity. We need enough sleep, which can obviously be a little bit elusive when you're working with a chronic illness, but we need to be sleeping. And, you know, there are obviously more complex things. The longer you've been unwell, the more distressing it is to live your life. And therefore, the nervous system can be very dysregulated in a lot of people with chronic illness. And we need tools to really support nervous system regulation. And that's what I teach in the Nurturing Resilience Group Program. I think at the time of recording this, think if the most recent round may have already started, but that might be something worth thinking about. You can always find out more details on my website. And so here, I guess I'm just going to wrap up by talking a little bit about my personal journey with hydrogen sulfide SIBO. And SIBO has probably been something I've experienced my whole life on and off as I track back and consider the symptoms. But it's something that I only sort of initially have become more aware of the more informed I've become, you know, with the training that I've had. And I think a major contributing factor for me was that when I was a child, I was put on antibiotics for very, very long periods of time. It was almost to the point of negligence. I can only vaguely remember the story, but I remember my dad telling me a story where I think I had changed doctors and the new doctor looked at my file from the old doctor and he said something along the lines of, "No child should be having this many antibiotics. This is absolutely ridiculous." So massive predisposing factor for me. And so I've always experienced a little bit of gas, a little bit of bloating when eating certain foods on and off throughout my lifetime. Sometimes it's better, sometimes it's been worse. And so that, you know, depending on lifestyle, what I'm eating, how much alcohol I'm drinking, how much I'm sleeping, how much physical exercise I'm doing, how much stress, you know, these factors have influenced the whole picture. But when I entered into this chronic fatigue syndrome experience, that was when things were the worst of the worst. And I battled with chronic diarrhea, sort of pudding or tea-like stools for maybe 15, maybe even at the worst 20 times a day, and experienced horrendous malabsorption as a result. I never did any SIBO breath testing, but I did do a stool test, and my stool test showed high amounts of this particular bacteria called D. sulfo vibrio piga, which is a specific bacteria which may increase the production of hydrogen sulfide gas. And this may be associated with a certain type of SIBO known as hydrogen sulfide SIBO, which we can't at this stage detect on breath testing. So diarrhea and pain are the most common symptoms of this type of SIBO, but it isn't very well researched at this point in time. And so I think I have spoken a little bit about this previously when we talked about malabsorption syndromes, because I had that as a consequence of the SIBO. But I followed a low sulfur diet. I did a lot of the interventions that I've mentioned already in terms of just supporting the gut north to south, supporting the nervous system, taking stomach acid support, taking digestive enzyme support, and then antimicrobial herbs, probiotics, low FODMAP diet, low sulfur diet. All of those things collectively worked really well. I also did some parasite cleansing as well, which I think made a difference. But my digestion can still be up and down. I'm still susceptible to relapse. And the reason why I wanted to mention that is because earlier on in this podcast, I said that, you know, you can have people with fatigue who don't have SIBO, and you can have people who have SIBO and who don't have fatigue. And the conversation I had with a client recently is like, you can have relapses in your SIBO, but it doesn't have to floor you as much as what it is right now. So we sometimes have to separate that there are multiple different mechanisms going on. I can experience a flare in my SIBO now, but not necessarily experience a dip in my energy. So I'd still do generally follow a low FODMAP diet or go through phases of following a low FODMAP diet, phases of taking antimicrobial herbs, phases of taking various gut support. And what usually happens is I do it for a bit and then I feel better and then I stop and then I get, then work gets busy and really stressful and then something flares and then I go back. So I still am experiencing the sort of relapses, so to speak, at times, but this is because of the, you know, my health history. They're having so many antibiotics at such a young age. It's probably just created lifelong changes in my gut environment that need to be managed. But that doesn't mean they have to floor me. So I still do continue to support my SIBO. I still do continue to manage my gut health. And more recently, I've added in some gallbladder support. And that was something I'd never really done before. And that's also made a really big difference, I think, due to that connection of how the bile influences the gut environment as well. So always learning and always refining my understanding of the body and all these processes and things that help. So I hope you have found this episode useful today. I hope perhaps if you have been experiencing some chronic ongoing digestive issues, it's given you a little bit more insight in terms of what's going on. As always, if you haven't already, please take a moment just to leave a review for this podcast. I think you can just do like 5 stars on Spotify, or if you have the time and you're on iTunes, you can even write a little paragraph. Your reviews really help other people find the podcast because it improves the ratings. And my intention with the podcast is just to create a body of information that I would have loved to have slowly made my way through when I was ill. And so if you have experienced the benefits of listening to this podcast, please pay it forward and leave a review, or share it with your chronic illness community, or share it with someone specifically that you know would help, whether it's this episode or one of the others. So I feel much more calm now and regulated after talking with you, much less stressed out about my parcel postage label adventure this morning. But I will be probably heading off to the library to get that printed and send that off. And I will see you in the next episode. Have a wonderful fatigue recovery day.